Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. The combined fears that swept over and consumed the United States and later other Western countries throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s are still lurking beneath the surface. Did the satanic panic ever go away? Let's get into it. Late in the 1970s, baseless conspiracy theories about devil-worshipping cults committed mass child abuse and murder spread around the North American continent. Talk shows and the nightly news fanned the public's fears, and the authorities investigated hundreds of allegations. Even as cases slowly collapsed and skepticism began to prevail more than a decade later, defendants went to prison, families were left traumatized, and millions of dollars would be wasted on public prosecutions. It is one of the most well-known cultural scares in recent history. Some call it the ritual abuse scare. Others refer to it as the daycare panic. But everyone has heard of it as the satanic panic. It was widely characterized at its most significant apex by scare-inducing media depictions of immoral and wicked teenagers and the dark, ungodly music and media which they consumed. In turn, this led to several high and significant criminal cases, the outcome of which were profoundly influenced by said social and media hysteria. Most people associate the satanic panic with presumed satanic ritual abuse, a phenomenon that arose from a rash of false allegations made against children's daycare centers in the early 1980s. The flames of this fire would be further fanned with the case of the West Memphis Three in the early 1990s. For those unaware, and to summarize, the West Memphis Three case occurred in 1993, where three teenagers were wrongfully accused and ultimately convicted for the murders of 3 8-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. Ultimately, the three convicted of the murders had nothing to do with the murders, and there was little to no evidence against them. However, prosecutors and the West Memphis police felt that their goth lifestyles, love for heavy metal rock music, and an interest in the occult literature that they consumed was enough to prove that they must be the guilty party. Inherently, satanic ritual abuse claims were largely based on unsubstantiated statements from children, excessively eager law enforcement, but more so the coercive and suggestive interrogation methods that therapists and prosecutors at the time used amply and with gusto. Some of the defendants in those cases are still serving life sentences for crimes that they very likely did not commit, and crimes which in all likelihood didn't even happen in the first place. The West Memphis Three were eventually released in 2011 after spending 18 years in prison, with one of them, Damien Eccles, spending that time isolated on death row. Their release still only came after the three convicts submitted Alford pleas, with their criminal records remaining in place. It seems justice can admit when they're wrong, but the West Memphis Three case stands as one of the worst examples of what happens when police rush to judgment without evidence and even more, abuse their power by acting on misconceptions and biased judgments over hard evidence. But even if the police are less likely to rush to judgment these days over rumors of satanic worship and occult influences, I say if, then the general public certainly have no such misgivings. I share the example that occurred in March of 2021. Please forgive my pronunciation, but Lil Nas X, the popular singer and rapper from Georgia in the United States, caused controversy with his music video for the song Montero, Call Me By Your Name. In the video, Nas, wearing very little clothing and dancing extremely provocatively, prances erotically with various incarnations or versions of Satan himself. Christians and the conservative right were up in arms and took to social media to protest against the satanic imagery. The same Christian commentators also seem to lose their shit over Nazi's releasing limited edition blood-infused Nikes, dubbed Satan shoes, a short while later. In fact, the controversy was enough for Nike to sue Naz over unauthorized use of its footwear. But was the outrage genuine? Did grown adults not see the metaphoric messaging in Naz's video and public behavior? Did they genuinely believe he was a Satan-worshipping corrupter of American youth? It's kind of hard to believe that it's anything but the first, but rationale and a huge sigh from my inner psyche confirms that I know deep down it's the latter. Just when we thought progress had been made since the 1980s and early 90s, we were reminded that we, as a society, are still right there. Still firmly implanted in that bizarre period in United States history, a period that we often look back on and say, what the fuck happened there? Its legacy threads through American culture and politics, in everything from social platforms to mass media to current conspiracy theories. The emergence of the occult. So, a number of factors contributed to the increased interest in, and fear of, the occult during that period towards the end of the 1960s and into the early 1970s. The Manson family murders and the Zodiac Killer, both in California and both roughly at the same time, not only sent fear into the American public, but also ended the summer of love and freeness of the hippie movement, with the dawning of a much darker decade. Organized ritualistic killing, occult rituals, and hard drugs seeped into the common perception. Alternative lifestyles of the 1960s led some individuals further down that path into a much more sinister realm. Eastern spirituality and esoteric belief structures entered our culture, and innocence was dissipating, or so it seemed. That same year that Charles Manson ordered his cult followers to commit ritualistic murder, organist-themed occultist Anton LaVey published his philosophical work titled The Satanic Bible. It has gone on to sell over 1 million copies. Critics of the treatise will argue that it's a book that is mostly plagiarized and largely regurgitations of earlier philosophies on self-occultulation and self-empowerment from writers like the popular 1920s cultural critic H.L. Mencken and the Russian-American philosopher Ayn Rand. Regardless, it became the seminal work of many modern Satanists, or LaVeyan Satanists at least, and also served as the key text for the Church of Satan, a group which LaVey had officially founded in 1966. Another tome that emerged and accompanied the rise of Satanism as a recognized practice was the 1971 publication of William Peter Blatty's hugely popular and best-selling novel, The Exorcist, and its subsequent blockbuster movie in 1973, titled with the same name. It seemed mass media was dissolving that small-town ideology. The Exorcist, with its claims of being based on a true story, side note, it was the 1949 exorcism of Ronald Hunkler in Cottage City, Maryland, provided the real-life inspiration. The Exorcist profoundly impacted America's collective psyche regarding the existence of demons and single-handedly transformed the popular Ouija board from a fun, harmless parlor game into a malevolent device capable of inducing spirit possession, demonic infestation, or other paranormal phenomenon. Satanism, horror movies, mass murders, good grief, it's all so fantastical in Hollywood, right? But then came the publication in 1972 of a book by Christian evangelist Mike Warnke, titled Satan Seller. The book, a fabricated memoir which was ultimately discredited more than 20 years later, recounts the childhood and young adulthood of Warnke, who claimed that he spent his formative years in intense satanic worship. Warnke wrote that he served as a satanic high priest and was engaged in, amongst other things, ritualistic sex orgies, kidnap, rape, the summoning of demons, a heroin addiction, and dark magical spells. Also in 1972, the publication of Anton LaVey's follow-up to the Satanic Bible titled Satanic Rituals reinforced the idea that dark occult rituals had become a routine part of life for many Americans. As a further addition, even though it wasn't strictly linked to Satanism or traditional occult religion, the 1978 Jonestown Massacre would give the world another ineradicable and shocking insight of what darkness existed in the world and what the violence of a cult looked like firsthand. The 1970s saw the rise of self-proclaimed Reformed Satanists, who insisted that the world was being run in secret by ritualistic satanic witch cults and paedophile rings, with the most senior figures in society amongst their members. John Todd, Herschel Smith, and David Hansen, in addition to the already mentioned Warnke, all grew up in Southern California and seemed to emerge from the still smoldering ashes of the Manson cult and Zodiac Scare, who subsequently declared that the world was full of dark occult symbols and far-reaching satanic conspiracies. They all claimed to have conversion experiences that made their stories appealing to Christians and the conservative right. Those folks live a good versus evil story and safety in the knowledge that good always prevails. All of these men were also linked to the emerging fundamentalist Christian right, you know, those madmen on the TV who sell God. Todd was supported by Christian tract maker Jack Chick, who used his fabricated claims as the basis for numerous comic book style pamphlets protesting against Satanism. And given the style of the work, this stuff was obviously aimed at and peddled to children and teenagers. Warnke spent over a decade passing as an expert. That's expert in inverted commas for those wondering. An expert in Satanism for the fundamental evangelical Christian community, passing off his entirely fictional childhood as a template for how real Satanism worked. He always came across kind of like those guys who preach against the dangers of drugs and tell you stories of their days as a junkie living on the streets and prostituting themselves for their next hit, only to find out that they've never taken an illegal substance in their life and they spent their 20s working as a baker in a mom and pop bakery in Delaware or someplace similar. The growing fascination with the occult also coincided with a number of extremely well-publicized serial killer cases that took place in the 1970s. We have already mentioned the Zodiac Killer, but it doesn't stop there. The Alphabet Killer is another murderer similar in behavior, both of whom used ritualistic patterns in their killings. Neither would get caught. John Wayne Gacy, the Hillside Stranglers, and Ted Bundy. Many of these well-publicized serial killers maintained an image of having the upper hand in some way over law enforcement, and led said law enforcement on a wild goose chase with his superior intelligence. Also, how can I not mention David Berkowitz, the son of Sam? He sparked a mass panic during the summer of 1977 in New York City, and to this day, there are significant leads that have never been fully investigated that link him to a national satanic cult. The Zodiac Killer and Berkowitz in particular also wrote taunting letters to the press and police, broadcasting their crimes and instilling fear into the general public. Ted Bundy, for example, escaped from prison twice and immediately resumed his horrifying killing spree across 7 separate states. John Wayne Gacy hid his twisted evil beneath the disguises of a friendly clown who performed for children, although he never killed dressed as the clown. As serial killers became more prominent and regular in occurrence throughout the 1970s, so the public fear went with it. Perhaps rightly so. This would later become to be known as the golden age of the serial killer in North America. Jonathan Mailer wrote in his 2005 book titled Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, of the impact that the Son of Sam had on the media during that fateful New York summer. Quote, "The frenzied media coverage fanned the growing sense of fear. The growing sense of fear fanned the frenzied coverage," unquote. It became a symbiont circle of terror and scaremongering. There's not enough mongers anymore, right? But Mailer's observation about the media fueling the mass panic would absolutely ring true well into the next decade. That's when heightened religious fears and the concept of stranger danger emerged together to form a new breed of mass hysteria in the 1980s. Stranger danger. The 1980s saw huge economic growth and financial prosperity. It was the decade that created the yuppie, or the young urban professional, if you will. Essentially, single white young men with way too much money. But it was also a time of cultural upheaval, centered on significant population growth, increased urbanization, and the rise of the double income family model, which triggered the necessity for a sharp increase in the need for children's daycare services. And what scares us more than the thought of leaving our own children with strangers? Anxiety about protecting the nuclear family from the unknown dangers of this new era was high. The spread of the AIDS epidemic, child faces or victims of kidnappings appearing on milk cartons, the social panic of the 1982 Tylenol murders, and reports of scary killer clowns attempting to abduct children. Let's not forget the emergence of trick-or-treat scares and the urban legends too. You know, for all the stories and scaremongering, America only has one Halloween killer. Ronald Clark O'Brien, who murdered his 8-year-old son Timothy with potassium cyanide-laced pixie sticks. He was executed by the state of Texas in 1984. Each of these moments of social unease and dysfunction signaled America's growing worry over stranger danger and the fear that evil could always be lurking right around the corner in your own neighborhood. Christian fundamentalism and a belief in angels and devils were on the rise during this time too. Fundamentalist preachers like Jerry Falwell and his Moral Majority, which were founded in 1979, gained prominence across the country. Whilst Christian television channels started as far back as 1961, it wasn't until the 1980s and the rise of cable television that religious television networks really exploded in popularity and reach. Anti-occult crusaders like Pat Pulling, who believed her son's death by suicide was the result of the role-playing board game Dungeons & Dragons, crusaded against D&D and other role-playing games, claiming that they were dangerous and demonic by summoning hellish entities within you. Pulling literally accused those who enjoyed the game of playing with the devil. Pulling was backed by occult fear-mongering from Chick and his Chick Tracts, an evangelical gospel comic book. Fearing Dungeons & Dragons and accusing it of being a route to Satanism seems absurd by today's standards. But does it really? It wasn't that long ago that Christian groups were saying the same about the Harry Potter books too. The evangelical movement wasn't alone in its growing occult obsession and scaremongering. The media also played a huge role in stoking the public's fear and fueling misconceptions surrounding occult practices. Our favorite, Geraldo Rivera, yes, the hard-hitting journalist of high esteem, produced a rather lurid documentary in 1988 titled Devil Worship, Exposing Satan's Underground. It became the highest-rated televised documentary to ever air up to that point. It's available on YouTube and it's worth a watch if you're interested in the satanic panic and, of course, understanding what was considered as genuine fears and cultural concerns back then. Although, by today's standards, it seems somewhat absurd in parts. In 1991, an episode of the popular investigative news show 2020, famously and terrifyingly for many, aired an official Roman Catholic exorcism. This is also on YouTube if you're interested. Just search 2020 Real Exorcism. With so much parallel emphasis on fearing strangers in your neighborhood and Satan in your home, a collision of the two was entirely inevitable. But what about the children? In 1980, a now discredited best-selling memoir titled Michelle Remembers entered the public forum. Written by an ex-psychiatric patient, Michelle Smith, the book detailed a childhood spent undergoing a wealth of shocking occult sexual abuse by its author. It was co-authored by Smith's Canadian psychiatrist and husband, Lawrence Pazder. Pazder claimed to have regressed into Smith's childhood through hypnosis. He purportedly helped Smith uncover memories of past abuse at the hands of members of the Church of Satan, which Pazder insisted was older than LaVey's group by several centuries. The claims made in the book and its allegations were repeatedly and thoroughly debunked. Pazder would still become a perceived expert in the arena of what would come to be called satanic ritual abuse. Lately, due to the mainstream media giving credence to Pazder's claims and supporting his book's allegations, even though it had been thoroughly debunked by various reputable sources back when it was released. Even though the book is at times highly implausible and the accounts within have been thoroughly discredited, Michelle Remembers was presented as a factual textbook during the 80s and early 90s for legal professionals and other authorities to gain understanding and training from. Its publication also allows for the various copycat memoirs which would emerge in the years that followed. Memoirs such as 1988's Satan's Underground, another memoir that has since been proven to be false, and an account entirely debunked of a massive intergenerational secret underground cult founded on satanic ritual abuse. A cult, it posited, not unlike one that is likely operated in your own town or neighborhood right now. Indeed, in fact, the devil worshippers could be anywhere. They could be your next door neighbor. They could be your child's caregiver. This is a quote by writer Peter Bebergral during a 1988 news report. The false account in Michelle Remembers would go on to directly impact the nation for over a decade. Its dark occult fantasies and scaremongering helped to spark the rash of wildly dramatic, highly unfounded accusations of satanic ritual abuse that were attached to a string of daycare centers throughout the 1980s. The belief alone that daycare centers across the country were delivering dark and evil occult acts of child abuse upon their young charges would be the most prominent fear of a broader daycare sex abuse mass panic, which was itself part of the 80s much broader wave of fear. This fear would ravage communities, lead to two of the most notorious criminal trials in US history, and ruin multiple lives before it finally subsided. And some of its victims are still serving sentences to this very day. And whilst we acknowledge the mistakes and shortcomings of the satanic panic, justice departments and authorities are perhaps too embarrassed to come forward to admit to all the lives that they have destroyed. The echoes that still ring out today. The earliest element of the satanic ritual abuse wave of cases began in Kern County, California in 1980. A group of Bakersfield social workers had together read Michelle Remembers and learned of a clandestine local occult sex ring from two children who had been coerced into fabricating the claims by an unsavory relative. Between 1984 and 1986, the investigation into these incredible claims would send at least 26 people to jail in a web of interrelated convictions, despite a complete and utter lack of corroborative physical evidence of any of the claims made against them. Almost all of these convictions have since been overturned, though it isn't always the case. One man who had served half of his 40-year sentence has now been released. Two parents who were sentenced to 240 years after their own sons were coached to accuse them of satanic abuse have also now been freed. A fast-moving, spiraling investigation, outlandish claims, no actual evidence, would become a familiar template. A well-trodden consistent for more than a decade, throughout the wave of failed prosecutions of satanic ritual abuse in daycare centers and schools across the United States. Even the psychological methods behind the unveiling of repressed memories would be thoroughly debunked in later years, proven to implant the memories in the first place, not to unlock said buried recollections. And what conversation about the satanic panic and ritual abuse can be told without including the now infamous and completely disastrous McMartin preschool trial, which became, and remains, the largest, longest, and most expensive trial in California history? In a nutshell, in 1983, a parent accused one of the staff members at the McMartin preschool in Manhattan Beach, California, of abuse. During the investigation, police allowed an unlicensed psychotherapist named Key McFarlane to conduct examinations of some 400 children who attended the daycare. McFarlane famously used anatomically correct dolls and coercive interview processes, thus resulting in a staggering 321 counts of accused child abuse being leveled against seven daycare staff members by 41 separate children. The staggering claims included allegations that the daycare owners and staff members had built secret underground tunnels that led to ritual ceremony chambers. Additionally, that they had ritually sacrificed a baby as an offering to Satan, flushed children down toilets, and could turn into witches and fly on a whim. That's right, and it was taken seriously by authorities, and they were prosecuted. After 6 years of investigation and a 5-year trial, the case would ultimately evaporate due to lack of actual evidence. though it took them that long to realize this. One by one, all charges against the daycare staffer members were dropped. The McMartin preschool building was razed to the ground in 1990. In true American style, the satanic panic also made people a few bucks along the way, of course. Seminars, tutorials, educational videos for the authorities, and evangelicals preaching on the subject of recognizing and fighting satanic cults swept the United States too. Many so-called experts came out of the woodwork, with all having next to no professional qualifications or experience in the subject. Of course. Law enforcement in El Paso, Texas, for example, were forced to attend ritual crime seminars and undergo satanic and occult training for the widespread wave of satanic crimes that was engulfing the nation. Classes were aimed at law enforcement authorities and social support organizations, taught mostly by other police officers, therapists, preachers, and born-again Christians claiming to be former high priests or reformed escapees from ungodly, sadistic ritual torture cults. The United States Justice Department thoroughly debunked the myth of the satanic ritual abuse cult in 1992, although most accusations of this sort of crime had started to die out by this point. By the mid-1990s, they had pretty much dried up altogether. Law enforcement continued to treat Satan as a potential criminal indicator, though. As we hear in this clip from the 1994 police training video titled "The Law Enforcement Guide to Satanic Cults."
In satanic occultism, that which is good is bad, and that which is bad is good. And as you view this learning and educational tape, pay attention to notice the reverse of everything that is normal becoming abnormal.
Eric Pryor is a former satanic high priest turned Christian who now spends his time educating people about the dark side of satanic cults.
When I was a practicing occultist, oftentimes I would come into this park and practice on various different holidays, lunar holidays and occultic holidays, and we'd actually have rituals in the park when we didn't have a space to do rituals indoor. So what I'd like to do is take you into the park and just kind of show you one of the places that you would start asking your questions and start looking to see, you know, what the occultists are up to. There's two different communities that use this park. One is the pagan or occultic community, and the other community is, of course, the homosexual community. Interestingly enough, they go hand in hand. And so, well, see, here you go. Upon entering the park, I mean, you can see they've already got started. This is a pentacle. Interesting thing about this pentacle is it's an upright pentacle. This is not a satanic pentacle. Now, the reason why this pentacle would not be considered satanic is because it has one point up. Now, Satanists would reverse this star, or pentacle as it's called, and have two points up. Those represent the horns of Baphomet and or the horns of Satan. But now, right over here, I can see on a tree here, there's a inverted cross. Now, this is satanic. This is a very generic symbol. Let me see. It's actually fairly fresh, too. This here, of course, is a bastardization of Christianity, and it's a very common symbol. Obviously, they probably had a party or a ritual here within the past night or two.
I appreciate that this clip is audio only, but to clarify, each of the symbols that are being discussed by Eric Pryor in this video are all spread, painted across trees in a paint that's conveniently by the same person and using the same single paint. As I said, it's taken from a United States law enforcement training video. Today this video seems laughable, but the humor fades when we consider just how many actual people were prosecuted due to these brazen and non-existent stereotypes. The voice you hear in this clip is a so-called satanic expert and former satanic high priest named Eric Pryor. Both of those claims are his alone, and very little evidence is available to support them. In the early 1990s, Pryor worked with the Jubilee Christian Center in San Jose, California, from which he managed to get the attention of law enforcement for a very short while while he was a key speaker at the police seminar in 1991. He taught police how to identify and deal with satanic crimes and devil worshippers. It was that seminar that led to the recording of this video. Now, I could dedicate an entire episode to the life and times of Eric Prior, a con man of the highest order, but I won't. Although, do check out our Instagram, as I've added some further information about Eric Prior and his bullshit there. Of course, the most damaging misconception about the fallout of Satanic Panic is that it ended in the early 1990s. Whilst most satanic ritual abuse cases eventually resulted in overturned convictions, there are, at the time of writing this, at least three people still serving prison sentences for crimes that likely never happened. In 1984, Frank Fuster, a Cuban immigrant, was accused, along with his undocumented wife, Liana Flores, of molesting eight children. Known as the Country War case, should you want to dig deeper, law enforcement at the time of the investigation conducted a number of interviews, now deemed coercive in nature, with Fuster, and despite that and no actual physical evidence in the case, charged Fuster and found him guilty on all counts. Fuster was sentenced to 6 consecutive life terms, or a minimum of 165 years in prison. He remains there to this day, having been in jail now for 39 years. He will be eligible for parole in 2134, when he will be 193 years old. His wife served just over 3 years in jail, then was deported to Honduras, having been tried as a minor given that she was 17 years old at the time of her arrest. Fuster currently has no legal representation. Recent scientific evidence also supports his innocence, though prison is where he languishes still. Fuster's sentence is sickening when you consider there was no evidence of his supposed crimes, but he's not alone, far from it. North Carolina resident Patrick Figgard was accused of sodomizing children at a babysitting service run by his girlfriend's mother back in 1992. Now in his 80s, he is still serving time following his conviction for said crimes. Once again, coerced allegations of ritualistic abuse landed him in front of the judge. Figgard, an executive at an electronics company, was said to have engaged in satanic rituals where he wore a mask and dark cloak, lit candles, and burned Bibles. He allegedly told his victims, who were all under 10 years old, that he did not believe in God, before sodomizing them with a screwdriver and forced each of them to drink dog's urine and human blood. Figgard fell under suspicion when 2-year-old Matty Blackstone developed a genital infection. Blackstone was being babysat by the mother of Figgard's girlfriend. After Blackstone was given a physical exam, she was questioned by a local social worker named Nancy Burson. Burson firmly believed in the existence of satanic ritual abuse. She was also well aware of the allegations sweeping across the country regarding secret satanic covens who preyed upon little children. A simple infection caused Benson to quiz Blackstone with pressured, coercive, and outlandish questions about being the victim of ritual abuse. Burson suggested Figgard's name as he was the only man in the house. Blackstone was 2, so agreed with Burson's leading questions. No evidence, no witnesses, and the sole word of a pressured 2-year-old ended the life of Figgard in a heartbeat. Cases like this from the 1980s and 1990s are in no small amount. The list goes on and on. One Florida school principal spent 21 years in prison after being convicted of false satanic ritual abuse claims. He was released at the age of 80 and ordered to move to another county. In El Paso, Texas, 2 preschool owners each spent 21 years in prison due to similar accusations. All were later proven to be false. In 1984, 3 members of the Amaralt family in Malden, Massachusetts, were convicted under false child molestation charges following yet another pattern of false memory coercion and lead-in pressured interviews forced upon children. 2 of the defendants in this case spent 10 and 20 years in prison before being paroled in 1999 and 2004, respectively. A 3rd defendant died of cancer in prison before her conviction could be overturned. She was later exonerated in 1998, the year following her death. In 1997, 4 lesbian women, who became known as the San Antonio 4, were targeted and wrongfully convicted for child molestation claims. their trial played out against a resurgence of satanic panic tied into homophobia in a conservative state. Their fight for justice lasted almost 2 decades. All 4 women would spend 15 years in prison before having their convictions overturned in 2015 and expunged 3 years later. And let's not forget, of course, possibly the most notorious criminal case to emerge from the satanic panic period, the case of the West Memphis Three. In 1993, 3 teenagers, Jesse Miskelly, Jason Baldwin, and Damien Eccles, all from West Memphis in Arkansas, were accused and later convicted of the horrific sexual assault and ritualistic murders of 3 8-year-old boys. The 3 teenagers were accused based on hearsay due to their goth lifestyles and image, and rumors that they worshipped Satan, even though there was again a lack of any physical evidence. The teenagers liked heavy rock music, read books by Aleister Crowley and Anton LaVey, and were from the wrong side of the tracks, so to speak. That was enough, it seemed, to land the 3 teens in prison, with one of them, Eccles, sentenced to death for being the leader of the 3, allegedly. There are a few fantastic documentary films about this case. West of Memphis, directed by Amy Berg, and also the Paradise Lost trilogy of films directed by Joe Berlinger and Brian Sinofsky. If you're interested in knowing more about this case, I highly recommend these pictures. Spoiler alert, the 3 teens, or men as they were by this point, were eventually freed in 2011, after DNA evidence emerged that shows that the teenagers could not possibly have had any connection to the killings. They entered Alford pleas, which commuted their sentences to time served, of 18 years in prison. I might produce a series of episodes in the future regarding this particular case. It's fascinating, and there are so many layers to the story. It's especially intriguing given the amount of suspicious characters who were involved in the case, with the actual murderer still at large and unknown to this day. The legacy of the Satanic Panic. Because of the high profiles and infamy of such over-the-top cases such as the McMartin trial and the West Memphis 3 case, the American public slowly but surely grew to become skeptical of satanic ritual abuse claims. Although, despite the debunking of the many myths, the satanic panic continued to sweep the Western world and impact the lives of far too many innocent individuals. In the United Kingdom in the early 1990s, one British man came under suspicion of murder and endured months of psychological entrapment by police due to his proximity to the crime and his interest in the Wiccan religion and other occult hobbies. Indeed, in my own personal experience back in 1992, I attended a school disco one evening. My friends and I were collected from the school gates at 9 p.m. by each of our parents. On the mountainside behind our school, we each observed a large ring of fire with smaller fires within its perimeter. The voices of several adults could be heard in its location. Now, there may have been a number of simple explanations for this. After all, in the countryside in the area I grew up, mountain fires were commonplace, particularly in the summer. That, however, didn't stop a number of the parents calling the police to report a satanic ritual in progress. Cue 15 police cars turning up, canine units and a helicopter, all searching for the supposed Satanists. Meanwhile, the parents rushed all their children home, some of which didn't return to school for over a week. The paranoia and fear was very real. Bringing things more up to date now, the infamous murder of British student Meredith Kircher in Perugia, Italy in 2007 led to the well-publicised trial and conviction of her American flatmate, Amanda Knox. During the trial, Chief Prosecutor Giuliano Migini suggested, without any evidence to support his suggestion, that since the murder took place the day after Halloween, Knox must have intended to conduct a sexual and sacrificial rite. The prosecutor invoked a modern-day witch hunt against Knox, with one lawyer describing her as, quote, Lucifer-like, satanic, demonic, diabolical, and a witch of deception. What a charmer. Amanda Knox spent 4 years in prison in Italy. Then on appeal, she would later be acquitted, then reconvicted, then reacquitted again. Knox was ultimately exonerated in 2015 after a harrowing ordeal lasting a total of 8 years. Whilst the most damaging effects of the satanic panic were felt within the legal system, there were also broader ramifications, and many of them still linger today. Fans of Dungeons and Dragons and other so-called occult games were demonized for many years. In fact, the game only became socially acceptable again in 2016, following its repopularization thanks to the Netflix television series Stranger Things. Additionally, strange conspiracy theories flourished out of the satanic panic, including rumors of subliminal messages in rock music, which eventually evolved into the PMRC Senate hearings. There's the creepy clown hoax of 2016, the Stranger Danger panic, rumors of high-level and powerful organized pedophile rings in the United States and UK, and the multifaceted governmental and world order conspiracies that blight the political landscape to this very day. Many of those conspiracies and strange rumors of illicit child sex rings still linger in the public psyche decades later. The 2016 clown hoax emerged as a metaphor for the long-standing myths about child predators lurking among us and relying on innocent-appearing methods of attack. It played out as a psychological reaction to historical moral fears. In fact, many right-wing Western conspiracy theories have ballooned into serious societal threats over the past decade, all emerging from the afterbirth of the satanic panic. One such example being Pizzagate. That conspiracy alone led to a staunch believer bringing a firearm to a Washington, D.C. pizza parlor in 2016. His claim being that U.S. Democrat politicians were secretly trafficking children for sex and holding them in the basement of a pizza parlor. 10 minutes of research might have told him that the pizza restaurant in question didn't even have a basement, but I digress. Talking of 2016, do you remember those hacked emails from John Podesta that leaked following an online spear phishing attack by the Russian cybersecurity unit known as Fancy Bear? Well, Podesta, you might recall, was the presidential campaign chair for Hillary Clinton. Within those leaked emails contained details of a dinner party that Podesta had attended, a fairly innocuous and uninteresting item within all of the said communications. Well, that was until somehow right-wing conspirators in the United States interpreted said dinner party as being a satanic ritual. The reasoning behind this theory, if you can legitimately call it that, was because the dinner party was also attended by the Serbian performance artist Marina Abramović. Essentially, in the emails, Abramović had sent a message to Podesta's brother discussing an invitation to a spirit cooking. This so-called spirit cooking invitation, it seems, was enough to trigger right-wing conspiracy theorists, such as the infamous Alex Jones, to determine that the satanic ritual was afoot. This was at the same time, roughly October 2016, where Jones also alleged that Hillary Clinton was not simply an especially craven member of the Illuminati, but more specifically, a literal demon birthed in the bowels of hell. Jones has evidence of this, he states, and people that he knows who were friends with the Clintons and the Obamas have allegedly told him that both of them permanently smell of sulfur, which is the smell of hell, apparently. Just saying these words together makes me feel a little unhinged. But anyway, skipping back to the case in point, i.e. the Podesta email, although the theory was absurd, Abramović has faced allegations that she is a practicing Satanist ever since. Now I get it, spirit cooking is a reference to an Aleister Crowley occult magic ritual where blood, semen and breast milk are mixed together and baked into biscuits, then eaten. But it doesn't take an expert to realize too that spirit cooking is also a playful reference to one of Abramović's past works, a 1996 published collection of her artistic works in portfolio form. In fact, in 2020, outraged conspiracy theorists disrupted and shut down a collaboration that Abramović had worked on with Microsoft, causing it to get cancelled altogether. The Abramović theory was tied to the notorious Pizzagate conspiracy, in that it was also politicized and also involved the idea that the Democratic politicians were secretly engaged in evil acts, thus weaponized political propaganda that the Greek, uneducated and devoutly religious, i.e. the Republican base, lapped up in barrels. Given the polarized United States political climate, it's easy to see how two similarly unfounded ideas, Democrats engaged in ritual Satanism and Democrats engaged in child sex abuse could become linked in the minds of some members of the public. And in 2017, that's just what happened. This is the so-called big lie theory. I have talked about it in previous episodes. Quote, if you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it, unquote. Yep, that's from the Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, who invented the theory in the 1930s. It's used widely in US politics today. I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat. I have no horse in this race. But one of the US presidential candidates uses this theory every time he speaks in public. I won't say which candidate, I'll let you work that one out for yourselves, but needless to say, it's deliberate and it's his entire political strategy. In October 2017, an anonymous 4chan user going by the user tag Q began claiming insider knowledge about a vast satanic pedophile ring involving US Democrats, high-powered celebrities, and world leaders. Q's conspiracy theory stated that President Donald Trump was pretending to be incompetent so that he could more effectively apprehend the pedophiles in government around him, and that Trump was a secret pedophile hunter acting as a lone ward within the US halls of power. Pedophiles who, in addition to practicing satanic rites and sexual abuse, were also trafficking children to harvest their hormones and make serums that would provide evil democratic politicians with eternal youth and endless life force. Sorry, I have to add a sarcastic joke here. If the Democrats are harvesting the power of eternal youth and endless life, why the hell is Joe Biden leading the team? He is quite literally the opposite of what this magical serum is meant to provide, no? Anyway, the Q conspiracy quickly became known as QAnon, the name for both the theory itself and Q's followers. As QAnon spread more and more in popularity, it became a textbook example of satanic and moral panic in action. Its followers weaponized cultural and parental fears of harm coming to their children and families, not to mention the rot it created in society, and grew to spread its message across social media. The group would use hashtags like the superficially unobjectionable hashtag SaveTheChildren and also disguised itself against takedown attempts by Meta, who owns Facebook and Instagram, by masquerading as a straightforward anti-human trafficking community. But, just like the original Satanic Panic, it spread under a mass prejudice, hostility to change and fear of the unknown, and beneath all of its performative and exaggerated concern for the welfare of children. QAnon too hid something much darker, because in 2019 the Federal Bureau of Investigation identified the group QAnon as a domestic terrorist threat. They cited numerous acts of violence and militant recruitment efforts being perpetrated in the name of QAnon. The pattern came to a head in January 2021 when hundreds of QAnon supporters joined the insurrection at the United States Capitol building. Now, obviously I'm not stating that the Satanic Panic turned into QAnon. Of course I'm not. One was a moral panic across Western suburbia, the other is a right-wing organization. QAnon is a political movement with real political power and influence. And while Satanic Panic was fueled by religious zeal, QAnon is almost a religion unto itself. That aside, the tools used to spread both ideologies, alarmism, fear-mongering hysteria, and reports of wildly gothic scenes of blood-drinking, child-harvesting for body parts, and witches, all bear the same virtually identical traits. The most horrific fears right under your very nose. 2024. Throughout the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, the media fueled a public wave of fear that spurred entire groups of rational thinking adults to collectively buy into a cultural outrage. Parents and prosecutors, therapists and investigators, jurors and judges, reporters and readers. The narrative swept up and absorbed everything along in its path, including and especially the victims from all age groups and generations. The abusive mechanisms of the Satanic Panic were the same as those of previous periods of mass hysteria, from 17th century witch hunts to McCarthyism, from National Socialism in 1930s Germany to Communism in Soviet Russia and China. In a time of deep social upheaval, it's all too easy to see these mechanisms falling into place once more. Ready to bend towards the next, unresistant, easily ostracized stranger, eager to label them as dangerous. Distant and unfamiliar religions and culture provides that scapegoat today, for example. But of course, crazed clowns, demonic board games, satanic rock music, foreign countries and their unfamiliar cultures, nefariously painted political ideologies, mythical religions or entertainers peddling satanic clothing and triggering the conservatives, no matter what it is, the satanic panic shows us that's not the real fear. The real fear is that tomorrow someone could decide the demonic influence is you. The satanic panic never ended. We never got over it, and nor do we know better now compared to back then. We are nowhere near at that point where we can look back and laugh, despite thinking that we really are. We just paper over one panic with another. Society still loves a witch hunt. I can think of a number going on in the media right now. I'm going to leave you tonight with the voice of Damien Eccles, death row survivor of the West Memphis 3. Good night.
Whenever they first arrest you, you're in such a state of shock and trauma at having your entire world, your entire life destroyed, that you can't take in much of anything. You're just moving along almost like a zombie, wherever they lead you. You know, people used to say things to me all the time, like, if that were me, I would have been fighting and screaming. You know, I would have been in court screaming I didn't do it. Well, no, you wouldn't. Not after they beat the hell out of you the first time for opening your mouth. You just move along almost in a state of being shell-shocked. I guess it sinks in little ways. The first time that I really started to realize what was happening was whenever the jury comes back into the room. They had been out deliberating. They come back into the room, and I look over at them, and one of the women on the jury starts crying. And I knew right then I was screwed. Also, after you get to prison, it's like walking into the most cold, soulless, empty environment you can imagine. You know, you're not even looked at as a human being anymore. They take away your name and give you a number, dress you just like everyone else. To them, you're not even human, so they don't look at you that way. They don't treat you that way. If they're hurting you, it's not like they're hurting a person. They're just doing something almost to an inanimate object. And whenever you start to feel that and feel yourself being bombarded with that sort of energy, it starts to sink in really deeply then. Also, after I first got there, the guards, it was almost like it was nothing personal. They just decided they're going to welcome me to the neighborhood. So they beat the hell out of me for about 18 straight days. You realize when something like that's going on, you don't live in the world anymore. You've gone someplace else. You've been sent someplace else where they can do anything they want to do to you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
When did that occur to you as the new normal? After you had stabilized, after, you know, the beatings became normal, you get used to the food. How does one go from planet Earth to death row and keep breathing? You said that the early days were almost like being a zombie, walking around in a coma state. When you finally came out of that, what did you think of your environment?
I was in prison probably 5 years before I started to really come out of that flight or fight response and to be able to function even semi-rationally as a human being anymore. 5 years it took. But even then, that's not a one-time thing either. You know, to take it in, for it to become the new normal, is also a process, because the horror and the atrocities and everything else you see keep building. You know, for in the beginning, you're dealing with things like the food they're feeding you, just how horrendous that is, or the conditions you're living in, the bugs, the rats, the heat, whatever it is. As soon as you start getting used to that, then they start executing people. So it's always like there's a horror, a next horror that comes along that's a little bigger than the last one. So you never really get used to it. And actually, after 18 years, the last 2 years that I was there were probably the worst in terms of brutality. There was a guard at another prison had been involved in a beating where he beat an inmate so bad he lost an eye. A couple of the local newspapers started writing stories about it, so they realized they've got to get this guy out of this prison. Instead of firing him, they promote him to warden and move him to my prison. So even after 18 years, the horror and brutality was still escalating.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.